Washington Post is reporting that Brian Pagliano, the Hillary Clinton aide who established that basement email server, has been granted immunity by the FBI.
It's in our DNA of our country to explore, and we must never stop doing this. We must lead, we must learn, and we must discover.
There is only one campaign that has consistently over and over again beaten Donald Trump. Our campaign is the only campaign that has beaten him now four times in four different states.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is 5:09 and it's Thursday, March 3rd, 2016. Welcome to another day, and it's snowing in Chicago. If you're just getting up, plan a little extra time. The roads are in decent shape, but you'll want to put a little extra time on that just in case other people are driving slow this morning. And isn't it nice in that sound clips to hear Scott Kelly back on Terra Firma, arriving back in Houston last night? Yes, we are an exploring country, and explorers we all are as we get up every morning. And then Nick on his show this morning had the guy who's riding that bike constantly. It really puts in perspective your day, and if you have troubles, they're really not that big compared to the rest of the world. Speaking of the rest of the world, here's your global market intel today. Asian stocks are higher. Wall Street logged modest gains yesterday, and there was solid labor market data yesterday, despite the weakness in the U.S. manufacturing sector. As Vic was telling you, Japan's Nikkei is up. South Korea's stock market up as well. The Dow Jones Industrials yesterday gained a modest 0.2%. Standard & Poor's was up just a little bit. The NASDAQ up too. We're waiting today to see a couple of important business reports. The Labor Department is going to report on how many people applied for unemployment benefits last week. The department's also going to reveal fourth quarter productivity data. Also today, the Commerce Department will release factory orders for January. And there are two major non-governmental reports out today. Freddie Mac's going to talk about mortgages. And the Institute for Supply Management, a trade group representing purchasing managers, will issue its service sector index for February. So we'll see if people are buying stuff, or at least companies are ordering stuff so that we can go buy stuff. Defense Secretary Ash Carter has told the tech industry audience that he was speaking with yesterday that strong encryption is essential to the nation's security, adding that he is not a believer in backdoors or encryption programs that leave openings for outsiders to read coded files, i.e., FBI versus Apple. Carter said yesterday he wasn't commenting on the FBI legal battle specifically, but he does say his views are very strong on this. The encryption debate is very serious and needs the serious debate and the going over that it's getting right now by Congress and the courts. And that brings us to our first guest this morning on The Opening Bell. It's somebody who's been writing about this and monitoring all of the details of what's been happening with Apple and the FBI in San Francisco from Recode.net. Kurt Wagner is the senior editor of social media for Recode. He's on Twitter at KurtWagner8. Kurt, you've been watching these FBI hearings this week. We had the FBI director, James Comey, up before the Senate committee or the House committee earlier this week, and one of Apple's top lawyers. What were the takeaways from this, or the highlights from all the testimony this week? And what stood out from your vantage point?
Well, I think the big highlight, and there were a lot of people who were covering this earlier, was that the FBI kind of finally came out and said, hey, we made a mistake when we first collected this iPhone from the attacker. The FBI had tried to get information from the phone, and in doing so, they tried to reset the password. And Apple's technology is set up so that when you try to reset the password, it automatically locks everyone out of the phone. And so, you know, for the first time, the FBI kind of said, hey, we screwed up. We tried to change this password. It ended up backfiring. Now we're locked out of the phone. And that is, of course, why the FBI and the government has been trying to force Apple to help them kind of break into the phone, if you will.
Because the techies I've talked to have said, had they done this the right way, they probably could have got in and we wouldn't be in this situation right now.
Yeah, so obviously when you reset the password or attempt to reset the password, the existing one no longer works. And so all of a sudden they're, you know, kind of trying to break into something where they don't really have the keys anymore. which is why they all of a sudden need, you know, Apple to kind of come in and write special software for them to get onto the phone. So I think had, and obviously hindsight being 2020, but I think if you had been a little bit more patient when the phone was initially collected, you know, they made this mistake, they said, in the first 24 hours after they got it. So, you know, imagine if you'd waited a few days, maybe tried to figure out the landscape of what they were dealing with, probably could have avoided a lot of what they're dealing with now.
It was hard to get a read on this committee because some of the members of the House were very critical of Apple. Others were critical of the FBI, some even going as far as suggesting that maybe Apple was doing something un-American and maybe helping the terrorists. Where do you think they're going to come down on this? Do you think it's going to be Congress that's going to take care of this or the courts?
I think that it should probably be settled in the courts. And the reason I think that is that, you know, politicians have so much riding on kind of aligning with their particular party, right? And I think that there's a lot of interests that they may have that a court of law probably doesn't have. So I think that if you kind of want the most objective opinion here, it would probably be best to have this happen in the courts. I obviously don't know what's going to happen, but I think when you look at how a lot of the tech companies here in Silicon Valley are really rallying behind Apple, they're, you know, putting out public statements of support, and they, a lot of them have products that also deal with user privacy and encryption and safety and things like that. And so I think the tech community really wants this to fall Apple's way. And they have a lot of, you know, influence and resources as well to try and kind of shift that narrative. So it's going to be really fascinating. I think it needs to happen in the courts, though.
We'll continue our conversation about Apple with Kurt Wagner coming up from San Francisco about the FBI and encryption. Our next segment, we're also going to be talking about some of these encryption issues facing Facebook. We'll be back with him.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the program. It's 520. We're talking with Recode social media editor Kurt Wagner via Skype from San Francisco this morning. Another takeaway from the hearings this week for me, Kurt, was the FBI's admission that it doesn't have the technical ability to break into this iPhone or any iPhone itself, any of these new iPhones at least. This is the preeminent law enforcement agency in the world, and it can't do this? I mean, this must be some really solid encryption.
Well, I think the big highlight, and there were a lot of people who were covering this earlier, was that the FBI kind of finally came out and said, hey, we made a mistake when we first collected this iPhone from the attacker. The FBI had tried to get information from the phone, and in doing so, they tried to reset the password. And Apple's technology is set up so that when you try to reset the password, it automatically locks everyone out of the phone. And so, you know, for the first time, the FBI kind of said, hey, we screwed up. We tried to change this password. It ended up backfiring. Now we're locked out of the phone. And that is, of course, why the FBI and the government has been trying to force Apple to help them kind of break into the phone, if you will.
Because the techies I've talked to have said, had they done this the right way, they probably could have got in and we wouldn't be in this situation right now.
Yeah, so obviously when you reset the password or attempt to reset the password, the existing one no longer works. And so all of a sudden they're, you know, kind of trying to break into something where they don't really have the keys anymore, which is why they all of a sudden need, you know, Apple to kind of come in and write special software for them to get onto the phone. So I think had, and obviously hindsight being 2020, but I think if you had been a little bit more patient when the phone was initially collected, you know, they made this mistake, they said, in the first 24 hours after they got it. So, you know, imagine if you'd waited a few days, maybe tried to figure out the landscape of what they were dealing with, probably could have avoided a lot of what they're dealing with now.
And so on to, you know, the other issue with this being the where we go now and the FBI's ability. How do you fall on that? I mean, this, again, must be some solid encryption.
You know, even Apple has come out and said, hey, if we really wanted to do this, you know, we'd have to take some of our top engineers and it would take a while. It would take, you know, probably a couple days to break into this phone. And so when you think about, okay, if the company that built the software and the company that built the hardware is going to take a few days to break into it, and they know every little nuance about, you know, the technology, imagine folks who, yes, maybe they do work at the FBI, but it's just, I think it's very complicated, and it's very, they set it up this way for a reason, because they want to, for 99 times out of 100 prevent people from getting into these phones. This is the one instance where obviously it's the opposite. So I'm not technical enough, unfortunately, to know exactly how challenging it would be. But I think you bring up a really good point, which is that we kind of assume that the government and the FBI has people who are smart enough that they could figure this out on their own. And I'm not sure why they have not done that yet.
The issue of encryption landed an executive from Facebook in jail in Brazil. What happened there?
So Facebook has been dealing with some issues in Brazil, and it's not actually Facebook so much as it is Facebook's messaging app, which is called WhatsApp. And WhatsApp is incredibly popular in Brazil. And a few times now, authorities down there have requested or required Facebook and WhatsApp to hand over user conversations in criminal cases. So criminals are using the app to communicate. The government and agencies, police agencies down there want that info. So they're asking Facebook to hand it over. And Facebook and WhatsApp are saying, we actually don't have those messages. Our, you know, service is encrypted such that the messages only exist on the phones of the users who send them. We don't have them stored on any servers. Finally, the Brazilian government apparently got sick of that response because this has now happened a few times. And so they picked up a Facebook executive, I'm told, while he was on his way to work, detained him for over 24 hours. We hear now that he is no longer being detained, but obviously Facebook was not at all happy about that.
And it brings up the point of how global this issue is and how heavy-handed some other countries might be with these corporations. Is this a threat that faces Apple and other companies just like Facebook?
Oh, absolutely. I think any company here, and you could list off a handful, Apple and Google and Facebook and Twitter, a lot of these companies, they build their products on this idea that users can interact in a safe and private way. It's a big part of why people use those services. And I think that we've focused a lot on how that's, viewed here in the United States. But then when you look and you see this instance happen in Brazil, you look at what Facebook's dealing with in countries like India, these are big markets for them, markets that are really important. And I think that they're going to run into these same issues in all these different markets. And as we learned, like, not every country is going to behave in the way that maybe we're used to having authorities behave here in the U.S., I think it's going to continue to be a challenge for them as they seek to grow outside of the U.S., and so we'll see how they deal with that.
You've also been writing about Snapchat. In January, they had 7 billion video views. Now they're up to 8 billion. Are they going to be at 9 coming in March?
I hope I hear about it if and when they do. It certainly seems like they're headed in that direction. They announced the 8 billion number at a conference with investors here in San Francisco just earlier this week. And, when you jump from 7 billion to 8 billion in the span of about 2 months, I mean, that's a pretty lofty jump. And they've been moving really quickly. I think they were only at 2 billion video views a day around May of last year, or maybe slightly earlier. But, you know, you can see they've gone from 2 up to 8. In a year. Pretty significant. They put a lot of time and resources into getting video onto the app. And I can't imagine that it's going to slow down much from here. So I'm sure we'll be hearing about 9 billion video views sometime soon.
And why is it important, the number of video views that they're at this level?
Well, video advertising is more lucrative to a lot of these companies than, you know, banner ads or even just, you know, static image ads that appear in feed. And so in order to convince people that, in Snapchat in this case is a good use of their advertising dollars, especially for video advertising dollars, they need to say, hey, our audience loves video. If I'm a television advertiser, I maybe going to go advertise at Snapchat so long as I believe that I'm reaching an audience of people that's going to be receptive to that ad. So the more users are watching video, the better pitch Snapchat can make to advertisers and say, hey, we have a video hungry audience. Your ad would be great here. And, they're going to make more money that way. So that's really what all this comes down to, is that the more video views that they have, the more engagement they have, the more money they can make from advertising.
And they're certainly getting to the point where they're giving Facebook a run for its money, right?
So that's what it looks like from the numbers. So Facebook's last publicly reported video view number is actually 8 billion as well. So on paper, they're at the same level. Facebook hasn't updated its number since November. I would imagine it's significantly higher than 8 billion. I'm not sure why they haven't shared it yet. But as of right now, since we don't know exactly where they're at, Snapchat and Facebook, we got to assume, are kind of at the very least close to one another. And I think that that's pretty impressive. I mean, you look at Snapchat's audience is a little more than 100 million daily users. Facebook has over 1 billion daily users. So they're watching roughly the same number of videos despite having only 10% of the audience. So I think a lot of people have taken notice.
Kurt Wagner is a senior editor of social media for Recode in San Francisco. You can find him on Twitter at KurtWagner8 and read his stories on social media at recode.net. And to Twitter for Recode is at Recode.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
It's 5:39. Welcome back to the program and good morning. It's time to talk about innovation and startups, and who better to lead that conversation with us this morning than our very own Scott Catoon of Tomorrow's Business Today on WGN. He's with us this morning. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I was thinking about you yesterday because I was thinking how fun it would be to have a segment on our show where we go over all of the terms of startups and innovation, like unicorn and some of those other, and just do like a game, maybe like a game show or just a quiz and kind of quiz
play
people.
A game of Scrabble.
Sure. Because there are a lot of the terms that I'm still learning too, because I'm kind of new to the startup and innovation world, and you're kind of teaching me some of that stuff. Unicorn's my favorite. I like that.
It absolutely is my favorite. Yeah. Actually, you know, I had somebody call me a unicorn personally the other day. I don't even know what that means. So I'm still trying to figure out what the application is there.
Right. I think it might be a compliment.
I hope so.
Yeah.
And they're still talking to me, so
yeah.
It can't be bad.
Well, and speaking of talking about you, the folks out east are talking about us. One of the big-time magazines, online magazines, It's technical, and then .ly is the way they got that domain. But they're talking about Chicago and our tech scene here, and apparently we've kind of scored big in their minds.
Yeah, technically is based in Baltimore. They've got a bunch of branches now: Philly, New York, D.C., and so on. And I've actually had the editor in chief, Zach Seward, on my show, and this was about 5 months ago. He was sort of, you know, he went to school at University of Chicago, so he's somewhat familiar with the scene here. But he wasn't really, I don't think Chicago was on their radar so much. I think honestly, in the last 6 months, we've had so many different investments and so much more capital flood into it now. I saw a recent rating saying that we're the sixth best funded startup company or startup city, which to me, you know, I don't know that I agree with that necessarily yet. But I will say the funding is starting to come into Chicago, which is a fantastic thing. What they covered with regard to the technically story was three major things that they noticed about the Chicago startup scene. And I thought it was really interesting, especially when you consider some of the conversations that you and I have had on this show, where we talked about that Chicago hangs its hat on its hard work, you know, bring the lunch pail, so to speak, on our diversity and openness to working and having a lot of female founders, not a lot necessarily as much as we should, but more than a lot of other cities. And another thing that is really interesting about Chicago is its accessibility. What they covered essentially was they talked about numerous, you know, we have over 30 Fortune 500 companies that startup guys have access to numerous universities that are fantastic, Northwestern, University of Chicago, so on. And the fact that most people in Chicago or the Midwest, if you will, sort of have this a certain humility and a certain, you know, let's just get down to hammering those nails and get the job done. And that was what they kind of hung the hat of the story on. They said people in Chicago are really open to working with new people, and they show up and they want to get involved. And that, I think, sums it up very well.
Yeah, we're going to link people to this. I'm going to tweet out the link to this story, but it's actually quite complimentary. The author of this article talks about Comcast, and there's a quote in there about how, you know, we're a city that prides itself as a city where people get things done. One of the examples is Xbox, obviously. In Chicago until it moved and was acquired by Microsoft. But there's a lot of stuff that's sort of under the radar that's going on right now. Can you give us, peel back the curtain just a little bit and let us know what kinds of things are happening in this area?
Yeah, I'll tell you, you know, you said Xbox, the game, it was the game Halo that was based here in Chicago that got bought by by Microsoft. But speaking of that, this is sort of an interesting Chicago tieback, also to University of Chicago. So like this pub, there's a company called Infinicine, which is based in 1871, and it's a TechStars company. They graduated from their most recent 2015 graduating class of TechStars. And essentially, it's just another platform for people to watch video games, literally sit there like an audience, like you'd watch the Bulls play. Unfortunately, last night wasn't fun to watch, but usually watch the games. This is a platform for people, generally younger people, to watch video games being played. That may sound strange, but the reality is there's a company called Twitch.tv, which actually a University of Chicago graduate, Colin Carrier, is actually the chief strategy officer for. Get these numbers. These are crazy. 115 million monthly viewers spending an average of 12 hours watching user-generated video game streams every week. That's how many people are sitting there watching. That's how big the market is, sitting there watching other people play video games.
And don't they have actual – you can actually go to arenas and watch – because it's a big deal to watch. It's like a sport. Yeah.
It's incredible. And what Infinicine is trying to do here in Chicago is get into that market. And they actually just raised $1.8 million from TechStars. If that gives you an idea of how much money or how much interest TechStars and some of these other companies have in this market. It's a really interesting scene because, you know, think about the growth potential there. You're hearing a little bit more about augmented reality. You're hearing more about having the ability to have, you know, three-dimension in watching sort of the virtual reality world. I think we've talked about a few companies in the past here that are growing out of Chicago in the virtual reality game. And, you know, and the more you watch what's going on in the startup scene, not just here, but in, you know, out west, there's a huge market of it's not TV. It's people playing games, people participating, people being part of the whole game, and people watching it. And it's really, to me, a very fascinating industry that is sort of growing out of what used to be kids sitting around a video game and parents yelling at them about going outside and meeting new people. Now there's billions of people just sort of culminating in online cloud watching others play.
Well, the article back to the one you talked about earlier about us being humble and not talking it. You know, this is one of those things that we should brag about, and we're glad we have you on to do it. Scott Catoon, the host of Tomorrow's Business Today on WGN Plus, and one of our startup and innovation experts here on The Opening Bell. Have a great day, Scott.
You too, Steve. Thanks so much.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It's 550 Dow futures showing an open that'll be probably negative when the opening bell rings later this morning. The Dow futures are off 2 points now. The S&P futures are off a point. Generally a mixed night on world markets. Let's find out what's happening in the commodities world. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Thank you, Steve. Good morning, everyone. Finally, a green screen yesterday on the grain market as wheat, corn, and soybeans all rallied to end the day slightly higher. Wheat, after hitting six-year lows the past few days, ended up 4.5 cents yesterday in that March contract. And there was some short covering in the market that helped soybeans close up 3.75, and corn closing up just slightly. As we turn to the livestock futures trade yesterday at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, live cattle futures ended the day lower. Part of that was profit-taking because we had seen a run-up in the live cattle market over the past several days. The trade, though, is still waiting for some actual cash sales of steers in the southern plains. And yesterday, there were cattle being offered at $140 to $142 a hundredweight, but buyers were only offering $136. That's our time this morning. You all have a good day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You have a good day as well. The Federal Trade Commission is out with its top consumer complaints that it's received over the course of the past year. Those complaints are received and categorized by the FTC's Consumer Sentinel Network and put together. And guess what? There's a new villain this year. Joining us this morning from Washington is ABC News correspondent Megan Hughes. Megan, who's the new villain?
debt collection, which is a bit of a surprise. For the past 15 years, identity theft has been the number one complaint of consumers. And just for some perspective on what this list is, the FTC puts this out every year. It's a list of consumer complaints, and it's not just complaints to the FTC. It's complaints that come in to state and federal law enforcement agencies, national consumer protection groups, non-governmental organizations. They put it all together. They put it in a list, and this year debt collection has topped identity theft for the first time in 15 years.
Are these just the average run-of-the-mill debt collection calls, or are these those aggressive calls that we've heard of in the past?
Well, it's illegal debt collection calls. So, yes, the very aggressive calls. And part of the reason that it appears that this trend has happened is that it's become a lot easier for consumers to complain because of different apps that are out there now, including Privacy Star. So it identifies the caller and allows the consumer to more easily complain directly to the FTC when something like that happens.
The Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, has said it's trying to combat this. How do they do that?
So they actually just in 2015 ramped up some of their enforcement against companies that are violating laws protecting consumers. So it was actually called Operation Collection Protection. They had 70 different partners bringing 130 different actions. And, of course, you can expect more of that in 2016.
Can consumers be confident that that when they do report something like this, it's going to be handled by somebody? Because I know I made a complaint once and I just thought, well, I put it in the email system and it's gone. Do they really look at those emails and are they really counting them?
You know, I don't know as far as a case-by-case basis, but I do think that this list is significant, and I do think that they have plans in place. As I mentioned, identity theft has been huge, and they've seen it actually, even though it's still number two now, there's been a huge increase in identity theft complaints, specifically tax identity theft. So people filling out tax forms so that they can get your refund. And they've got identitytheft.gov that they've just made some upgrades to. So they're working on a lot of different fronts, but I don't know how much they can get in the weeds on a case-by-case basis.
The identity theft issue, aside from taxes, has always been one of the top 10. Is there any hope that they're finally getting a handle on this, or that they might someday? Because it just seems every day we're hearing of another tragic story of somebody who falls for one of these scams.
Right. And I think what's tricky about it is that they have to keep up, number one, with the technology, and number two, with different kinds of scams that are popping up in different places. One other thing that was interesting, this list also shows the states where the complaints are the highest. So for fraud, for example, Florida has the most complaints. Now, the one thing you don't know is whether or not more people are complaining about it in Florida or more people are actually experiencing fraud and those kinds of scams. For identity theft, it was Missouri.
And unwanted calls to mobile phones, speaking of technology, is up. Why is that?
I think as technology evolves, it becomes a lot easier for people to figure out the system and figure out how to game the system. And that's something, again, that FTC constantly needs to be evolving and moving to combat.
Is there any advice from the FTC for consumers on how to prevent this sort of thing from happening or how to react when it does?
The FTC, in releasing this list, didn't make any direct advice for consumers. I think the action of reporting and the action of trying to get this data out in the open is certainly a first step.
3 million people complaining, that's a lot of complaints, isn't it?
It is. And that's up from 2.6 million last year. So it's a significant increase. But again, does that mean people are getting more savvy in terms of reporting and getting this data out there? That's the question that isn't answered.
ABC News correspondent Megan Hughes with us from Washington this morning. By the way, after debt collection, identity theft, and imposter scams, the top three, the remaining top consumer complaints are telephone and mobile services, prizes, sweepstakes, and lotteries, banks and lenders, shop at home and catalog sales, auto-related complaints, television and electronic media. Then at the bottom, credit bureaus, information, furnishers, and report users. You can learn more, by the way, on Twitter at FTC. Also at FTC.gov is the main website. And we've sent a link out this morning on our Twitter account for more information on these consumer complaints. That's the opening bell for this morning. Thanks for being with us. Our producer is Mary Sandberg. Our engineer is Ben Cortez. Thanks to Ross Cochran and Kevin Powell for production help this morning. We'll be back bright and early tomorrow morning for another edition of the opening bell. The Steve Cochran Show's next. It's 5:57.